Welcome to this episode of Tea with Twiggy. It's great to have you here. This is a podcast where I catch up with friends and people that I find fascinating. I check that they're doing okay and ask for tips to help us stay at home more comfortable. My guest this week is the lovely Alan Titchmarsh, the definitive voice of all things botanical and horticultural. You know him from his wonderful gardening programs and also his amazing novels that he writes. Please stay tuned to the end because Alan is going to give you some tips for your garden. Hello, Alan. At last.
Well,
it's so lovely to see you. I just explained to everyone, we tried to do this a week ago and my tinternet went, gosh knows where it went, but it went somewhere. So I apologise profusely and you were so gentlemanly about it.
That's right. I've had a week to get more nervous about your grilling.
Well, I'm very nerve-wracking, aren't I?
So intimidating, always have been.
Well, the first thing, obviously, because you're having tea with me. Have you got a cup of tea?
I have got my cup of tea. Here we are.
What do you drink? Anything?
Need you ask? Yorkshire.
What a stupid question. How do you take it?
Very little milk. No sugar.
Sugar. Good boy. Well, I've got lemon and ginger today, but I like a good strong cup of, we call it builder's tea, because my dad was from Lancashire, you see. So we couldn't say it was Yorkshire tea.
It's a wonder I'm talking to you, really, isn't it? I do remember having tea once somewhere up there. The guy, when I was working in the Parks Department nursery, and the guy said, oh, this is shamrock tea. So I said, what, shamrock tea? It was very weak. He said, it's shamrock tea. I said, what's that? He said, three leaves.
That's brilliant. Somebody should make it.
It would go a long way, wouldn't it?
So where are you talking to me from?
I'm talking to you from my barn in Hampshire, which is just alongside the house where
Lovely.
I live. It's an old Georgian farmhouse with about 4 acres of ground, but which about 3/4 of an acre is garden proper. And the rest of it is really sort of nature reserve. I've got a wildflower meadow and a wildlife pond that we dug out. So it's a lovely little part of Hampshire in an old house. And there was a long, long, 100-odd feet long barn made out of something called marmstone, which is like very hard chalk. And when we came, it was derelict. We've been here 18 years now. And so we restored it. And I've got, some garages and a potting shed at one end and my study and library at the other end. And that's why the rafters you can see behind me.
It looks gorgeous. Study. I was going to say to you, a stupid question to you, but you must have a garden, obviously. So, yeah, but most of it is wildflowers, just 3/4 of an acre, an acre garden.
Yeah, and that's garden proper. And I do like my garden. You know, it's important to me that the garden is lovely. Well, I do it. You know, it's what I do. It's part of my life. It's part of me.
It's not like a busman's holiday when you get home.
No, I just love it. I mean, it's a vocation rather than a job. You know, I just love doing it. So
before I get into that, the last time we saw each other, we were eating strawberries and cream and drinking very nice champagne at Wimbledon last year. Do you remember?
Weren't we lucky? Do I remember there? You and I
in the royal box, no
exactly.
less. Very posh.
Yeah. No. It
wasn't
was
it a fabulous day?
Yeah. Alison missed afternoon tea. We came late for afternoon tea because I have a wife who's a very keen tennis player and loves watching Wimbledon. She said, I'm not going in for afternoon tea. I want to watch this match. So I like tennis, but I also like afternoon tea in the Royal Box of Wimbledon.
It was a fab day, wasn't it?
It was wonderful. The weather was good. The tennis
I've
was
really
good.
Missed it this year, actually. Have you? Watching it on TV.
Well, we've missed everything. And Ali's very sporty. And I do love sitting there watching a bit of Wimbledon. So and we've lost the Olympics. You know. So, yeah, it's been a bit sad for sport, really.
I know. I feel terribly sorry for the people, especially the Olympics, you know, the competitors, because they train for so long to get to that point.
I was talking to Claire Balding a couple of days ago, and she said some of them will benefit from it.
Who
weren't quite there and who've got another year now to get ready for it, they'll benefit. But of course, there will be, or anybody who was injured and thought, damn it, I'm going to miss the games, you know, they'll have time to recover. But of course, as I said to her, but there'll be others who will feel they've just gone over the hill in another year.
Gone past the peak.
Yes.
Yeah, so, it must be so And also that adrenaline that builds knowing the date you're going to go. And then when that goes, it's like if you're doing the only thing I can align it to is if you're doing a stage show and suddenly the opening night gets postponed for what reason. Yeah. It's so peculiar because you build that kind of adrenaline for that night.
There's a mental progress, isn't there, in that, where in your head, somehow, even if it's weeks ahead, you are mentally geared to one date. And there's something very clever about the conscious and subconscious in that they do gear up and you're not always aware of it. But only when it goes wrong do you realise that it's thrown a spanner in the works. Yeah.
Also, the other thing that often happens, and it's, I mean, I haven't done that much stage, but I did a big musical on Broadway and...
Excuse me. I did a big musical. I haven't done much, but I did a big musical on Broadway.
Lots and lots and lots of stage, like lots of people, but I've done a bit. But I remember the build-up to that was so intense because it was a big show. Mm. And 2 days before opening night, I got a sore throat and kind of a cough and a cold, And my co-star, Tommy Tune, who's a famous tap dancer, wonderful tap dancer, he put his hip out.
Oh, no. What a pair.
So, but we opened amazingly.
This is my one and only, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I got pumped with God knows what to get my throat clear so I could sing. And Tommy kind of did all the tapping except the kind of big kick things that he does with those long legs. Mm. But we got through it. But that, again, that's adrenaline.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Doctor theatre, they call it, don't they?
They do. Well, yeah. There's famous stories of ballerinas actually breaking their toes, and they do. They carry on dancing, and then when they come off stage,
collapse in a heap.
Then they collapse in a heap. Now, I've read a story. I've got to ask if it's true that your reporting began in the late 70s where you reported a plague of green fly in Margate. Is this true?
I did. Absolutely true.
It's
brilliant. I'd left Kew Gardens. I started my life as an apprentice gardener, and I then went to college for a year in Hertfordshire. Then I went to Kew Gardens as a student for three. Then I taught there for a couple of years. And from there, I went into journalism as a gardening books editor. And then I became deputy editor of a gardening magazine. And we used to get calls from, BBC saying, can you field somebody for this, that or the other? And I'd already started doing little bits for You and Yours, the radio programme on Radio 4, sort of, Good Friday, tell us what to do in the garden this Easter weekend. And they started using me for odd little news, if newsy things happened. And the Today programme used me as well. I was asked on the Today programme because it must have been about June, I think. There was a warm wind blowing across Europe. And it really suited greenfly, and it brought millions of greenfly across the channel. And there were decorators painting shop fronts in Margate, and suddenly, woof, all their paint was covered in greenfly that had blown over. So I did a bit on Today in the morning where they said, come in and tell us what to do about all these greenfly. And it was in the days before I was organic, and I've been organic for about 40 years. So I was probably recommending various noxious sprays to get rid of them. Anyway, somebody heard me from Nationwide. Do you remember Nationwide?
Yeah, I do.
Was that early evening current affairs show. It's only famous for the skateboarding duck. It did a lot more than that, but that's what everybody remembers. And they said, come and tell us how to control greenfly. So that was my first taste of TV, and it was live in the evening. And at the end of it, they said, oh, you were wonderful. The Marvels, come back. And I went home full of the kind of, they said I was wonderful, I must go back. Well, a year later, I had another phone call because somebody had a roof garden in a block of flats and it had collapsed into the flat below. And they said, come and tell us how to make a roof garden without it collapsing into the flat below.
Oh my goodness.
I went and did that. And they said, oh, marvellous, wonderful, loved you, were great, you must come back. So I came home and said, oh, usual thing, Anyway, the following week, they rang up, and I don't think I've been off the telly since 1980. That was 1980 then. My first one was 1979. And I sort of did Nationwide and Breakfast Time, and then all the rest followed,
That's amazing. So that was the beginning of your amazing television career.
I owe my career to greenfly. Never
disparage them. Has there been a plague ever since or not?
No, just the one. So timing was everything.
Well, somebody up there was looking over you.
They were, absolutely. And don't like the plague of boils and locusts. They sent me a plague of green fly. It did me a lot of good.
Actually, wasn't there a couple of weeks ago a plague of locusts somewhere?
Yeah, but mercifully not in this country. And
no,
they really
where was
do
it?
That.
I read it
somewhere.
It was somewhere
overseas. Was it somewhere in the States? In South America,
it might have been, yeah. Unbelievable.
But they absolutely, you know, they come in and within hours, things are just totally denuded. I mean, green fly only sucks sap. Locusts eat foliage, so phew.
It must be terrible. What if they land on you? What do they do?
Oh, well, not much because
they don't
tougher.
Bite or anything.
No,
do they?
No, just tough okay. old skin. They flit off.
I won't run if I see a locust.
No, they are big though. They're, you know,
I actually envy you working at Kew Gardens. Was it amazing?
Well, it was, and I mean, it is the best plant collection in the world. And
it's
my parents, when they only took. I don't know how many do they take now. It's a three-year course, and they take, in those days, they took about 15 students a year.
Wow.
Out of all the hundreds of applications. So my parents bought me a transistor radio for getting in.
Oh, how sweet.
But I worked in the Palm House, you know, that wonderful big greenhouse there, and I looked after a plant that Captain Cook had brought back, and they said, don't kill it.
No pressure.
It doesn't like being overwatered. Oh, my goodness. But don't let it dry out. Oh, crikey. Anyway, it's still alive. I went back last year. It's still there. Yeah.
Did you give it a hug?
I did. We had
a conversation.
And
say, remember me?
Yeah.
I didn't kill you.
Yeah.
But haven't you found it? I mean, the other reason, apart from I love talking to you and we've known each other for a long time now.
We have known.
It's when the lockdown happened, it seems that so many people, when they were able, if they had a garden, took to gardening, even if they've never gardened. Even me a little bit, because I'm not really a gardener, but Lee loves it, my husband. He's out there all the time.
I found it very heartening because it's always meant so much to me, and it's been my salvation through life. I was a classic late developer at school and not particularly good at anything, but I could grow plants at home and made little greenhouses out of polythene. And I've always seen it as the sharp end of conservation and environmental care because it's interactive. It's not just looking at stuff. It's not like a bird watcher where you're just watching. You actually sow seeds, take cuttings, interact with nature, help nature along. And I've always loved it, as well as wildlife. You know, I joined the Wharfdale Naturalist Society when I was 8, and I'm still a member. And I've always just, you know, spent my life being a sort of evangelist for gardening and growing things. And so the fact that people were, in a way, confined to their gardens, I thought, oh, this will be interesting. And so many people did find it enormous solace. And, you know, mental health has been a big thing
for their mental
through
health,
lockdown. Yeah. And just to get out there, and even for me, and, you know, and I do it most days, but to be confined to my garden, and I didn't go out for nearly 3 months, except in the garden. I haven't been in a supermarket yet, which is wonderful. to be there every day and watch things grow every day. And I was out there from 8 till 8, sort of, you know, 12-hour days.
Wow.
Because I love it. And
but,
yes,
you know, I read about people who've never gardened in their life and suddenly it has now become a passion.
I hope what people have realised that is if you look, if you observe, it's not quite as mysterious as you thought it was. Gardening should always be magical, but I like to try and banish the mystery and the fear of it. You know, and just say, if you do it, watch what happens if you give something too much water or not enough water. And you start to be able to understand their needs, and then it's a delight.
Well, we've been very lucky because we're in Sussex and we inherited, they think it's over 200-year mulberry tree.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah.
It's enormous.
Yeah.
And
now you're getting all the fruits dropping.
Yeah, my daughter can't wait. She said, you've got to pick it all, Mum, and I'm going to make jam. But it is enormous.
Yeah.
And you have to have specialists down, because it does need trimming, but we wouldn't know how to start.
They grow very fast. The thing about them is, actually, they can look older than their years, because they get gnarled very quickly. mulberries.
Oh, okay.
But it may be 200 years old. It may not be, because
this guy thought it was, but they haven't done any tests on it.
Unlike you, very badly.
Thank you. But he said you have to be careful how you trim it. So we're going to get somebody who knows what they're doing.
They put on a lot of growth. I mean, they put on 2 or 3 feet a year.
Oh, it's huge. Yeah. It's absolutely. Yeah. And the other beautiful tree we've inherited is jacaranda.
Oh, that's unusual.
Yeah, very unusual.
With it's quite
very
tender.
Purple, lavender purple flowers.
Oh, are we talking jacaranda or are we talking paulownia?
I don't know.
Is it the foxglove tree? No?
What's amazing about it, when it flowered, there were no leaves. It was just flowers. I thought it was jacaranda.
I think it's paulownia. Look up paulownia.
How do you spell that?
P-A-U-L, Paul, as in the boy's name, and then O-W... N-I-A, paulownia, it might be. Has it got massive, great round leaves when they come?
Yeah, but they came after the flowers dropped off.
Yeah,
it was
but
weird.
They are big and round.
Yeah, I think so.
I think it's paulownia.
I'll have to go and have a look, but I'm not going to...
Yeah.
Are they unusual or not?
Unusual, not, relatively uncommon. You see them about and, yeah, you...
So beautiful when they were like pale purple lavender. The whole tree was that.
They're like candelabras, aren't they, on the tree?
It was breathtaking, absolutely breathtaking. So I am learning little bits. I'll try.
As long as you're interested and you care, that's the thing, really.
Yeah,
that's just to care about it.
That's true. So you were saying when you were a little boy you joined...
The naturalists, not the naturists, because in Yorkshire there aren't many naturists, it's a bit cold, but lots of naturalists. I still keep up with them. They're a lovely organisation.
So did you know at that young age that's what you wanted to do, or it was just a hobby?
From being about 8, that's all I
wanted to be.
And so I took me art O-level a year early at 15, and I left school and became an apprentice gardener.
It's lovely when you know that early what you want to do, because it's a passion, isn't it?
It's lucky to know. And I think a lot of people don't. You know, it takes ages of being nudged one way or the other. And if you let life nudge you, which I'm a great believer in, it finds you out. You know, life finds you out if you let it. I remember talking to Dirk Bogarde, and he said, you know, don't go through life with one focus. It's saying there's a sort of feeling there's a corridor with a door you want to get through. He said, so many people go down, they said, that's where I'm going, I'm going to do this, I'm going there. They have a plan, a career plan. He said, and they get to the door and it's locked and bolted and they can't get in. And what they didn't realise, there were lots of side doors on the way where people said, come in. No, I'm going down there. And they led actually to an interesting journey, probably to the same place, but by a different route. And the bottom line from him was just be open to things that come from unexpected areas.
That's a brilliant analogy, isn't it?
Yeah.
Really, really brilliant.
And that's why I've ended up being a chat show host and presenting last night at the proms and all kinds of things. You know.
I say you've done it. Well, I listen to you on Classic FM as well.
Yeah, every Saturday.
I love those programmes. It's classical music always been a passion.
Yeah, because I was a choir boy from being, 10 or something like that. So church, and I used to go and buy classical records. Do you remember when he had a record shop and he had pegboard lined booths and he used to go in and singles were 4 and 6 and then they suddenly went up to 6 and 4. Isn't it sad that you remember things like that? Anyway, I used to go and buy, but I would go and buy classical records and ask for them to be wrapped in a brown paper bag so my mates didn't see.
Oh, didn't tease you. That's so sweet. Well, I can remember when, because I've got two sisters, one's 7 years older than me and one's 14 years older. But the one who was 7 years older, she was very into pop music. And this must have been in the late 50s, early 60s. And we didn't have a record player, but she used to buy the records. I think they were 78s, weren't they, then?
Oh, way back. There were 45s, I think, by late 50s, I think.
45. Oh, well, then they might have been 45. Yeah. But I can remember she'd buy them and then we'd sit down for our tea and she'd pass them round the room so we could...
look at it.
We couldn't play them.
Well,
so
now you see, we were quite smart because we had a Fidelity record player, but our Fidelity record player, you could actually put the lid down when an LP was playing. Now, the cheaper ones, you had to leave the lid up.
Yeah. Well, my dad felt so sorry for my sister that he eventually, because he worked in the film studios, he was a master carpenter, and he managed through one of the guys to get a second-hand, do you remember those little blue and cream portable players?
That's right, covered so in sweet. Sort of Fablon, weren't they? Kind of,
yes. Yeah. So she could play at last, bless her.
I love the image of her just handing them round so you could touch this precious
item. I must have been about 7 or 8 and I thought it was amazing. I mean, simple pleasures.
Oh, God. I do remember buying my first... I did buy She Loves You. I bought a few pop records as well, but it was mainly classical. But I remember the very first 45 record I bought in the paper sleeve was Russ Conway playing China Tea. There you are, yes. Tea with Twiggy. China
there we
Tea
go.
With Twiggy.
That's right. My first memory of a record... Well... A record that I had was Cliff Richard's, I think, Living Doll.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I think I was about 6 or 7, and my friend Jennifer and me, we used to dance to it in our little party dresses. But it's such a strong memory, isn't it?
Yeah, hugely strong memory.
Music.
Well, you and I both, you know, we both met. Well, you probably know Cliff a bit. You know, you probably know him better than I do.
I know him.
Isn't it wonderful when you actually get to meet the people who... And you feel so embarrassed at saying that they were part of your formative years, you know, because you think, yeah, because everybody must say that to them, you know. But just for yourself, it's quite nice to be in their company and think, cool, I never thought, you know, there we are.
Well, I always think that about the Beatles because they were such a huge influence on the world.
Yeah.
Not only us. And what's happened with them, their music has gone on to the next generations and the next generation. I mean, my little granddaughter is 5. She loves, you know, a lot of the Beatles songs because my daughter plays them.
It's a test of a good... people don't really use the word tune much nowadays, but it's the test of a good,
good tune.
Well, it is because you get apart from the things you suck to get over your sore throat. because look at the catalogue of Beatles hits that have become orchestral versions, that have been cover versions by people. And you don't hear many modern groups or individuals whose songs are covered by anybody else. People don't do cover versions anymore, probably because they're not worth it. They're much more ephemeral.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's like it's almost the same thing like the Gershwin, you know, George and Ira Gershwin. You know, they've travelled on. And
yeah, Jerome Kern. Yeah, Rodgers and Hammerstein.
Cole Porter, they're absolutely amazing. Now, obviously, and we watch them every week, your gardening programs, because they're brilliant. and actually, it's one of my daughter's favourite programs every week.
Oh, God, I've translated to a new generation.
You have? Yeah. Well, she's 40, so with 2 little ones. But the other program I love that you did, I don't know if you're still doing, obviously not through lockdown, but The Secrets of the National Trust. How did that happen? They're brilliant.
What was great was that, you know, if you call a programme Secrets of the National Trust, you can't just walk around looking at what everybody else looks at as well, because what are the secrets? And the National Trust are notoriously precious, and quite rightly too, about the things they own and not letting people touch them, and they, you know, a lot of them aren't on view. We said that if we were going to make it, we really ought to live up to the title and show some things that people don't normally see. And I remember vividly at Lyme Park being allowed to hold the Lyme Missal, which is a big prayer book, by William Caxton, 1437 or something like that. And I said, you're going to let me hold it? Yes, hold it, you know. And I collect old books, so for me it was like kind of the Holy Grail. And it's been fascinating seeing the things that the public don't normally see and sharing them with all of us, you know. So, yeah, I've really enjoyed that. I've done about 3 or 4 series. I've finished now, I think, but there's a few more to go out still, yeah.
Oh, good. I'll say, I didn't know if you were... Well, obviously nobody's doing anything at the moment, but no shooting anything, but they are so wonderful. Have you got a favourite house? I mean, if you could have one of those houses in your dreams, which one would it be?
There's a little one called Kingston Lacey in Dorset, which is sort of 4 square, and it's a handsome house, and it sits in sort of open mowed lawns, unfussy, and you see the architecture of the house, the views are wonderful. And I thought... Yeah, this would do me. And
is that the one? There was one that you loved the garden because it had a kind of pyramid at the end.
That's the one.
Yeah, I remember that one. It's gorgeous, isn't it?
Yes, it's setting.
And when you looked out of the house, you could see the pyramid and the gardens.
Yeah, it was like
so
Cleopatra's
pretty.
Needle. Yeah.
Yeah, because some of those big houses are a bit, I don't know, a bit scary if you'd lived in them.
They're a bit
so
austere.
Huge.
A lot of them are dark. But we found some really good ones, interesting stories. Yeah.
No, it's wonderful. And I'm amazed that the National Trust let you in.
So am I. Knowing me, I mean, if they knew me like you know me, you know, they wouldn't let me in. Don't he drops things. Don't let him in. You know, I did hear a lovely story once. I remember in the days of Magnus Magnusson, I think he was doing a programme about the Romans or some ancient British civilization, and he was holding a piece of slate that was engraved, and apparently it was Roman. He dropped it and it broke in half.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
So, is that true?
I think so.
Oh, gosh,
I'm not impugning Magnus. It can happen to any of us, but I'm pretty sure I remember that.
But the other thing we did together, which I don't think they ran with, but it was such a brilliant idea, was the, I can't remember what you called it. What was it called?
Alan Titchmarsh's Walks of Fame.
Yeah, it was brilliant. I did the first one, didn't
you?
I
did, and it was the last one as well. But it was great. I think it was one of those programmes, if we're sort of talking a bit sort of in depth here, if you get a commissioner who commissions a programme and then they move on and somebody else inherits it, they don't have the same feeling of ownership about it. And that's all it was, because we had a lovely time in Southwold.
And the product was fabulous, wasn't it? We did it up in
Southwold.
Mm. In Suffolk?
Yeah,
Suffolk.
Yeah.
It's not Norfolk, is it? Yeah. Southwold. No, Southwold's in Suffolk. And you interviewed me, but on a walk, which was such a lovely way to do an interview.
Well, I think, do you know this? They always say, don't they? And if you've got a child who won't talk to you much, go and get in the car.
Yeah.
Because if you're not actually looking one another face to face, you're sitting side by side, more comes out. And in a way, on the walk, not that you wouldn't have talked to me if I'd have been facing you, but you just sort of, your mind can go when you're walking side by side, can't it? And I think you get some good conversation.
Also, we went to, Southwold is gorgeous. Mm. And all that place just outside Southwold we went to where the horses were, do you remember? And we walked through that field. It was so beautiful. I'd never been to that bit before.
Yeah.
And then we went along the pier.
We did. And we went to the little picture house, didn't we?
Oh, yes.
Saw a bit of the boyfriend.
That's right. Oh, gosh. Yeah. Is that the smallest picture house in the UK? Probably.
Certainly the smallest in Suffolk.
Well, it had about 8 seats, didn't it?
Yeah, it was
amazing.
But that was really rather strange, you see, sitting next to you watching The Boyfriend in the tiniest cinema in Britain, isn't it?
That's so funny.
Moments that you never forget.
I really enjoyed doing that show. It was lovely.
Yeah, well, you were good company, love. It's very kind of
you. Oh, well, thank you. Maybe you should try and do it again
with
other people.
I'll tell them. Do you remember? She says it was good and we need to do another
one. It's a brilliant idea.
Yeah.
I'd watch it anyway.
All right.
How long did you do Pebble Mill for?
10 years.
Because I did that with you a couple of times.
1987 to 1996.
Wow. Yeah. And that was live, if I remember, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
Yeah.
There were funny occasions there. I remember there was a big classical music awards ceremony going on. It was in Birmingham, obviously Pebble Mill, at Symphony Hall in Birmingham. I stayed in a hotel there when I was up. I was usually up there about 3 days a week doing it. I stayed in a hotel one day I was in the lobby in the hotel and Placido Domingo walked in and he was staying there for these classical music awards. I thought, oh, he'd be a great guest. And I got up to my room and I wrote a note and took it down to reception and said, do you think you could just get this to Mr. Domingo's room? I didn't want to confront him and put him in an unfortunate situation. But I just said to him, you know, you wouldn't come on the programme tomorrow, would you, by any chance, and do an interview and talk about the classic? And I got this phone call saying he would come on the programme. So the following day, Placido Domingo came on the programme. I had Evelyn Glennie on, the percussionist, profoundly deaf percussionist, and I'm sitting next to those two on this sofa and asked, which is a terrible thing to do, again, I shouldn't have done it, said to Placido Domingo, you wouldn't sing something, would you? You know, and he ummed and ahed. And then he took Evelyn Glennie's hand and he sang, sitting next to me, you know, your tiny hand is frozen. And, you know, and when you're next to a voice that is that big, not loud, big. You feel the earth move. And he apologised after. He said, I'm sorry, I took a moment or two to do it. He said, I was just getting the equipment ready.
He's the nicest man, though, isn't he?
Yes,
I did a television show in Florida. God, this was when I was doing my one and only on Broadway, and we flew down on a day off or a Sunday to go on the Bob Hope special.
Oh, gosh.
He was gorgeous. He was ever so funny. And Placido Domingo was one of the other guests. I didn't get to sing with him, unfortunately. But I did get to sing with Bing Crosby once.
Oh, no, you see.
I did.
And you see, my only excitement is Blooming Green Fly. Go on. Tell me about singing with Bing Crosby, because we want to know.
It was his last TV special. Wow. We didn't know it was going to be his last, obviously. But he came over from LA with his family, and they were doing a Christmas special in good old London.
Yeah.
And they had a set, I think it was at Pinewood, and his family were there. It was meant that they did like an old Tudor house set, so they were meant to be spending it in an old English house. And I was a guest, Stanley Baxter, David Bowie.
My goodness.
It was quite... Do you remember the clip of him singing with Bing, the little drummer boy? That's from that show.
Really? Oh, my goodness.
It's a famous clip. You can see it on... It's beautiful. I think they may have released it as a single, actually.
Right.
Him and Bing singing that. And I sang Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas with him. I was so nervous. I mean, I was only about... I was in my early 20s. And the thought of singing with Bing Crosby put the fear of God into me. I was so nervous. And he only liked singing live. He didn't want to do lip syncing, rightly.
Yeah.
So they recorded the track, and I sang it live with him. But it's gorgeous.
And have you got it? Gorgeous. Have you got a copy?
Well,
of
I've
it?
Got the clip.
Yeah.
It's beautiful.
Oh,
but my heart was pounding.
I'll bet.
But he had quite a colourful reputation, shall we put it that way?
Did.
Lots of people.
He was sort of as avuncular as he appeared on screen. Yeah. Apparently he was quite tricky, I think, wasn't he?
He was, apparently. Mm. But I have to say, maybe it's because it was in his latter years, he was charming to me, and we got on very well. And then we'd finished the show, because it was a Christmas show, but we shot it in September. And we finished the show. He went out. I said, are you going straight back to LA? He said, no, I'm going to go off and play golf, which was his passion. Mm. And he went off to play golf, and he had a massive heart attack. He won the round, apparently, and had a massive heart attack and died.
Gosh.
I mean, awful, but in a way, a wonderful way to go, because that was his big passion, golf.
And back at terrible few. Bob Hope, too, as well. I mean, he was a golfer, too, wasn't he?
Yeah.
I love that story about Bob, because I think Bob Hope was a bit of a naughty boy.
A little bit.
And he had one or two interesting things on the side in his marriage. And there's this lovely story. Dolores, his long-suffering wife, came back, apparently. Dolores was his wife's name. She came back, apparently, and found him in bed with some young thing. And he pulled the sheets over his head and said, it's not me.
That's brilliant.
Only Bob Hope.
God, unbelievable. But they were like there won't be the likes of them again, will
they? Aren't you grateful, really, to have gone through that period of your life, meeting legends, legend after legend?
I mean,
after
when
legend.
I think of the people I've met, I mean, I met and had tea with Noel Coward.
Oh, my goodness.
Unbelievable. Again, I was very nervous. I mean, I think I was 19 when I met him, and he was, in his 70s, late 60s, early 70s. And again, he was wonderful. And I just, when I look back and think, gosh, I actually met and sat and talked and had tea with Noel Coward.
Did you appreciate it at the time? I mean,
not as much as later, because I knew a lot of his songs.
Yeah.
And I'd read a couple of the plays, the famous ones, but I didn't know his... I mean, he was, I mean, what he wrote and what he did, unbelievable. How can one man write and create
Pleasant Laughter, Private
so many
Lives,
things.
Hay Fever, all that, and all those songs, amazing, wonderful songs.
The songs are so beautiful. I mean, I did, in New York, Sheridan Morley had put together an amalgamation of him. It was called Noel and Gertie. And it was songs and pieces from the plays that they did in London. And then we got permission to do it in New York from Sheridan. And Lee, my husband, he asked Sheridan if he could rearrange some of the songs and do the more famous ones that the Americans would know, and things that would suit me. And I played Gertie and Harry Groener played Noel Coward, who and he was wonderful. And what was lovely, when we did it, so many young people, because they knew me, we got quite a lot of young, not that I was that young, but we got 20 and, you know, because they love the 60s, 20-year-olds and that, who'd never actually heard of Noel Coward. And they'd come to the stage door and say, oh, you know, thank you for introducing. I'm going to go off and buy a record and I'm going to go and read his plays. And, and that was lovely because you think, oh, that's nice. Yeah. They saw us doing little pieces from his plays and singing the songs.
What was he like when you met him? I mean, was every line an aphorism? You know, you kind of get the thing. He never spoke in Norman sort of boring language.
I met him. What did he say? Oh, I know. Well, I met him in Jamaica. We'd gone out on holiday. I mean, I must have been about 17 or 18 years old.
He had a house there, didn't he?
Yeah, he had a beautiful house. And we went to tea. We went to stay. I'll tell you what, I'm sounding name-dropping now, but we went to stay with Tommy Steele.
Yeah.
And he was a great friend of Noel's because they both had a house in Jamaica. And we were staying with Tommy and Annie and we went to tea. And at that time, Tommy and Annie had a 2-year-old. I mean, she's probably in her late 40s now, but she was 2. And we were having tea and cake, and suddenly Noel, and he was in his dressing gown.
Silk, of
and
course.
And I've got a little picked snap of us actually sitting next to each other. I look absolutely petrified. I'm going like that. And suddenly he said, Annie, your child has something alien on her upper lip. And it was a piece of cake. But instead of saying, your kid's got cake round her mouth, your child has something alien
there
on her
so
upper
many,
lip.
So many stories about him. There's apparently somebody started, he was in Australia and he was going up in a lift and some Australian got in a lift and said, oh, Mr. Coward. He said, say something funny. So Noel Coward said, kangaroo.
But his songs, I mean, we did about 19 songs in that show. We changed the title to If Love Were All, which is one of his famous, beautiful songs. I sang that. And they're so gorgeous. They're so lovely to sing. And then obviously he did his lovely comedy ones.
Yeah. He did sessions. He used to go and do his cabaret in Las Vegas, didn't he?
Yeah. Well, he went kind of out of style here.
Yeah.
You know, like.
Yeah,
happens.
There was
the 60s came along
exactly.
And everyone thought he was old fashioned.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think he then got a gig in Vegas and hopefully he probably needed to make some money. Yeah. Don't we all? Yeah. And he went off to Vegas and huge hit there.
He is a bit
they
of a
loved
hero.
I love
talking to you because you don't name drop, but you fill me in on people whose lives have been a part of my life.
Well, you know,
life.
My hero, and I did meet him, my hero was Fred Astaire.
Oh, you see.
And I actually got to meet him.
I think if my wife, who was a dancer and then taught dance, and I'm a fan of his too, if Alison had met him, I think she would just have dissolved into a heap of a pool.
Again, he was one of the sweetest, most modest men you could ever meet.
Yeah.
And also, nobody danced like Fred Astaire in my book. To me, he was the greatest. But nobody walked across a room like Fred. Oh. I remember going up, we were invited to tea at his house, and I remember him coming in the room. It was a large room, and he walked across the room, and it was just that kind of...
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know.
But his feet didn't actually touch the floor, did they, really?
No, I mean. And he had cream trousers with a tie, you know, through the loops, tied in a knot, and a cream shirt. He was just so stylish. And I also think he was a great singer.
I did dance with his daughter once on Pebble Mill, funnily enough.
Oh, did you? With Arva?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, she's a friend, actually. She's a nice lady. Well, the reason I know her, when I was invited to go and have tea with him, because I told somebody at MGM he was my hero and I got an invite to meet her. I was 20 at the time. Arva was there. She was a little bit older than me. She was probably about 25. And years later, because we became friends... She said, you know why I was at the house with Daddy that day? Because she obviously wasn't living at home. And I said, no. She said, he rang me and said, will you come over tomorrow? Because Twiggy's coming to tea and I'm terrified.
uh. Anyway, so you do it to other people as well. Yeah.
Oh, I'm very terrified.
Intimidating, yeah.
Now, I know all about your, and everyone knows about your gardening books, but I'm a huge fan of your novels.
Oh, thank you.
You write really good novels, yes, I think. Yeah. The first one I read was The Last Lighthouse Keeper.
Yeah, that was the second one I wrote,
That was the first one I read.
Yeah.
What was the first one you wrote?
The first one was called Mr. McGregor, which was about a TV gardener.
It
was a little bit. It was a little bit racy. It wasn't remotely sordid. I don't do sordid, but it was a little bit racy. And I got kind of branded as someone who writes racy novels. I thought, oh no, please, it could be such a letdown when people buy them and they're supposed to be racy.
So
I got my comeuppance when you have to do, as you know, the audio book, and you find yourself reading out this romantic love scene, and the only other person listening is the other side of a sheet of glass, and he's generally rather large, bearded gent who looks anything, you know, not what you want to be looking at when you're reading a romantic scene. But yeah, I've written 11 now. The last one was, which I think you have written, is The Scarlet Nightingale, which is a
I finished that a couple of months ago. I absolutely loved it and I can recommend it. It's gorgeous. But you're a really good novelist. I mean, I love books. I love proper stories, you know, that have
Well, I try and write books that I would like to read. Yeah, beginning, middle,
exactly.
End, and you can disappear into them, you know.
You know, I mean, there are wonderful books that don't do that, but for me, I need a story.
Yeah.
So, well, I'm a huge fan, as I say, of your books. Now, I'd love you to give some tips, because of all these people who are, you know, trying to get into gardening now, and hopefully they will continue gardening. Any tips for people who haven't got big gardens, who maybe have a window box or a little outside space?
Yeah, the thing is, really, if you haven't got much space and you know your garden has to be in pots, don't get a dozen tiny ones. Get two very large ones. You can grow more in a big pot and they dry out more slowly. So, and you know, in really sunny summer weather, you're a slave to the watering can and the hosepipe if you're not careful. And a big pot, and I mean something sort of 18, 20 inches across, a hefty thing, you can plant anything. You can do vegetables and fruit in them if you want. When you're doing pots on a terrace or whatever, make them big. Try and make them all of one or just two different kinds of material. Otherwise, it looks very spotty and messy. If you're doing a veg patch, don't sow everything on one day in a 50-foot row. Do successional sowing. You know, unless you've got a family of rabbits, you don't need 58 lettuces one summer afternoon. So sow sort of a couple of feet a row every 10 days, and then you'll get this succession of lettuces and radishes and things like that.
That is a brilliant tip. I've always wondered that, because we had a garden once where we planted and we did get like 50 lettuces. Yeah. We didn't know what to do with
exactly.
Them. I think we left them out for the rabbits.
But also, particularly with vegetables, you need to make sure they never dry out. I don't mean keep them in a paddy field, but steady, steady watering, so they just keep maturing steadily, is the idea. And in the rest of the garden, just go out there and enjoy it. I mean, when the weather's very hot and the grass slows down, don't keep slavishly mowing it. But when it is growing, mow it once a week because it thickens up. It's like cutting hair. The more you cut it, the thicker it grows. And it's the same with grass. But as I say, not when it's bone dry because it doesn't grow much at all. But generally, from April through to sort of September at least, once a week.
Well, haven't you during the lockdown been filming a program Alison's been filming you.
She did. She's never held a camera in her life. She hasn't even taken a picture on her phone, I don't think. But she was brilliant. We did six episodes. It seemed to go down very well. We got good viewing figures.
That's a brilliant
She's
idea.
Now called Mrs. Scorsese. Her brother sent her a birthday card last week and said, when's your next blockbuster coming out?
That's amazing. Listen, thank you so much for having tea with me.
My pleasure. Thank you. Stay
and
well.
Give my love to Alison.
I will.
And let's hope we get to Wimbledon next year.
Be nice, won't it?
Please.
All right. Love, 40. All right.
Love, 40.
Lots of love, 40. Yeah.
Well, I really enjoy chatting to Alan. He's such a lovely man. He's a brilliant gardener and he really knows what he's talking about. So do follow his tips. That was brilliant, especially about the lettuces, so you don't get hundreds all at once. But what an interesting man, and I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. Anyway, I'm going off to have another cup of tea. If you've enjoyed listening to Tea with Twiggy, please take a moment to give us a lovely 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts. It really helps other people to find the show. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe to this podcast so you auto-magically get the next episodes for free. And do tell all your friends and family about it too. If you want to connect with me, I'd love to hear from you. You can find me on Twitter at Twiggy, or you can find me on Instagram at Twiggy Lawson. My thanks go to all the people that have helped this podcast happen. Many thanks to James Carroll and all the team at North Bank Talent Management. Thanks to all the team at Stripped Media, including Ben Williams, who edits the show, my producer Kobe Omanaka, and executive producers Tom Wally and Dave Corkery. The music you can hear now is my version of Waterloo Sunset by The Kinks. If you'd like to hear the whole song, you can find it and all the other songs I've recorded on iTunes and Spotify. So check it out. I look forward to you joining me for my next episode. So see you then. Bye.
You just heard a Stripped Media production.
Hi, my name is Kay Adams, and to be honest, I'm not so good with the aging process, so I enlisted my old chum, the filter-free Cara McKenzie, to advise.
Could you imagine being a porn star? The room would need to be really hot for me to strip off.
To be honest, she's not much help, but she is rather amusing. And along with some great guests, Joe Brand, Andy Oliver, Anton Dubek, Ruth Langsford, and Craig Revel Horwood, darling, we are learning how to be 60. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.